So along those lines, I want to take this opportunity to introduce Deborah Allen, who has been the director of the Bureau of Child, Adolescent, and Family Health at the Boston Public Health Commission since July 2008. And prior to coming to the Public Health Commission, Dr. Allen was an associate professor of maternal and child health at Boston University School of Public Health and a co-principal investigator for the National Catalyst Center on Financing Care for Children and Youth with Special Health Care Needs. She's going to be talking about From Theory to Practice, Bringing Life Course Home, and I'm going to welcome her now up to the podium.
Thank you, Carrie. I can't quite figure out how to do this. I actually had a comment or question for Amy, but I'll raise it later. Maybe in the middle of my presentation, randomly. So I was thinking, sitting here, I used to be the Children with Special Health Care Needs Director for Massachusetts, and I became that just in the middle of my being that. The national agenda for children with special health care needs was developed, for those who are familiar with that, by the Maternal and Child Health Bureau, which really made that a much more exciting place to be. And then I became the MCH director for Boston just as Life Course was really beginning to flourish. And I think there should be a new fortune cookie that says something like, may you always enter a field around the time that it is flourishing intellectually, because your life will be much more interesting. Because, I mean, that's really been sort of a blessing, which is my way of saying thank you to the people in the audience. I want to particularly note Sharon Rising, whose relevance will become clear as I present, the people on the panel and the people in my field who've really made it not just a way of sort of feeling like you're doing the right thing for people, but that you're really engaging sort of your intellect as well as your heart in doing that so that you can do it well. So now to real-world practice. A little bit about Boston, which is where I work and the setting for the efforts I'm going to talk about. And this is a very practice-based presentation. It's a very contradictory city. It's a very rich city on the whole, compared to other places. I don't mean everybody in it is rich, but the median income is higher than much of the rest of the country. But it's a city with a very poor black population and increasingly a poor population of other communities of color, immigrant communities. It has some of the best healthcare facilities in the world. We usually rank, you know, one or two in sort of the prestige of our children's hospital, which John Reardon over there represents. And when, you know, when the MCOs around the country get graded, Boston and Massachusetts MCOs are always among the top, and yet we have incredible disparities in virtually every important health indicator. You see very sharp disparities between black and white. So it's a city of contradictions. My own agency, the Public Health Commission, has spent about 20 years trying very hard to address those disparities in terms of birth outcomes, with not much success. I think we've done very well by clients we've served in our Healthy Start program, which is part of federal Healthy Start, and our homegrown home visiting program, which is called Healthy Baby, Healthy Child. I mean, those have been programs that clients love being in and that do very well by their clients, but they have not changed the overall outcomes for the population. The agency, however, has developed, just as I've come into my position, an agency-wide focus on racism that has, because the city has these disparities across the board, they're not unique to my bureau and the population we serve, and so there's a real sort of fertile ground for life course theory in the agency as a whole, and a tremendous amount of support for thinking about what does an anti-racist approach mean in dealing with perinatal health and early childhood and so on. And that focus has led to, for example, anti-racism training of the entire 1,100-plus staff of the commission, every single person from emergency medical services, secretaries, to the commissioner have been required to go through this training. So a lot of thought is going into this agency-wide, and that's the context for my thinking. A little bit about birth outcomes. I don't know if you can read this. This is 2008, 2009. And what's particularly striking about this slide is that if you look at the top line, which is the infant mortality rate, you'll notice that the black rate dropped by about 50% from 2008 to 2009. The white rate sadly went up a little, but even if the white rate hadn't, the disparity would have dramatically declined. However, it's not really time to celebrate yet, because we don't know exactly why that happened. It's a one-year trend. We've yet to see if it's going to be repeated. And because it's a one-year trend dealing with relatively small numbers, it's not statistically significant. Now, it's hard to believe that a decline from 30 black babies dying to 15 black babies dying isn't important and meaningful, that it doesn't mean something. But we really, the data don't bear that out. So we obviously want to find out what's going on, but we still believe having twice the white infant mortality rate, or 150% of the white infant mortality rate, is still not, grounds for dancing, although looks like something good happened. But when you look below the surface of the statistics, the reason for continued concern gets even more clear. So this is looking not just at the number of babies who are low birth weight, but at how low birth weight they are. And the lower the birth weight, the greater the prevalence, the greater the proportion of that population is black. So this is looking at that when you get to the very low birth weight babies, the black rate is 1.8% compared to a white rate of 0.6%, so it's three times as high. And so the discrepancy is sharper where the outcome is more clearly associated with lifetime adversity. Same thing when you look at preterm birth. The more preterm you're looking at, the greater the disparity between black and white. So that underlying that infant mortality statistic and the closing of that gap, there's reason for concern about babies who are surviving, but are surviving under very adverse birth circumstances in terms of their long-term health. And when we've looked at differences between, over the years, we have tried, as have other communities, assuring that all black women have financial access to care, have, in fact, community support, case management to help them get into care. When we've looked at differences in terms of smoking, white women, as elsewhere in the country, smoke more than black women. And that difference is declining too, unfortunately, but white women still smoke more. And like other places, we find that black women who do not smoke have worse birth outcomes for many statistics than white women who do. So explaining it in terms of financing of care, access to care, personal behavior, all the sort of standard suspects for what explains black-white differences, doesn't give you the answer in Boston. And that really leads us to life course perspective as a way to shape what we do in some new way in the context of this overall agency anti-racist effort. And, our framework for looking at it predated the release of Amy and Milt's paper. It obviously has a lot in common, but we've sort of adopted our own homegrown version that drives our activities. And what it focuses on is, as in the presentation Amy gave, the timing of risk. So recognizing both the importance of early risk for shaping long-term trajectory, but really I think when we think socially, thinking about the cumulative risk is just as important, and sort of recognizing that at any point in the lifespan, the individual's health reflects the cumulative impact of their experience at all points prior to that. And then, is parallel to Amy's point about environment, our focus on social determinants, which particularly because we're trying to explain black-white differences, we want to think about in terms of racism. And then finally, I think this is our equivalent of your focus on equity, recognizing that stress plays this absolutely critical role, and that's where Life Course really has something new to offer us, is understanding that the way social experience gets into the physiology of the human being and their baby is through the psychosocial experience of stress and then the physiological experience of stress and what stress, and then the sort of complicated interactions between those two kinds of stress with the genetics and other biological aspects of the human being. So that set of four bullets is our framework for thinking about how we should intervene. And I think very quickly I'll go through these because you know them. So, increasingly strong evidence of the importance of early programming, The idea of cumulative risk and Arlene Geronimus's attention to weathering that really adds a sort of dynamic dimension, so that instead of thinking of it as totally deterministic, you can recognize that at any given point, you could intervene to do something that will stop the accumulation of further risk and ideally reverse some of the risk, the stress, the impact of stress that's already accumulated. One of the things that's been very interesting for us is to think about asthma, which is a focus of several bureaus of our commission. It's the most prevalent childhood, it's not the most prevalent anymore, but it's the cause of the most days of absence from school and the most hospitalization, certainly. So there's a lot of attention to asthma. And one of the things we've learned that has been just sort of totally dramatic in terms of pre-assumptions in my career is that asthma, rather than just being something you're kind of born with or not, is actually causally related or seems to be to maternal stress during pregnancy, and that asthma exacerbation is associated with stress in the family once the child is born. So that you can see both the sort of programming aspect of this in terms of the prenatal risk and the expression of it being affected by the cumulative experience of the family. This is just Boston's sort of personal picture of weathering. Those of you who are familiar with the expected curve of birth outcome, of birth weight in relation to maternal age, will recognize that the Asian numbers are a little funny because it's a small population in Boston, but the Latino and white curves in Boston more or less look like what you expect, which is some adverse outcome at a young age. Women get healthier and their lives get more stable as they enter the prime childbearing years in the 20s, and then the adverse outcomes go up again as they get past the prime childbearing years. And, you know, strikingly for one city that doesn't have that huge a population, the black outcomes look strikingly different. They're a staircase, and the older the woman gets, the worse the outcome, so that a 15-year-old black woman is likely to have a worse outcome, than a 25-year-old black woman, which is really anomalous and reflects this concept of weathering and the cumulative impact of race. Our list of social determinants. And then finally, this concept of stress as really fundamental. And I wanted to highlight this slide because I think the World Health Organization's kind of parsing out of stress gives us a way to really be. One of the things I think is very exciting about life course is that I think we have to think about the words life and course. Course being kind of the temporal aspect of it, and life being an instruction to those of us in public health and clinical care to think about what goes on in people's lives on a very fine-grained day-to-day basis. And the World Health Organization's parsing out of stress, I think, is a great framework for doing that. What the WHO says, and you know, it does wonderful work in this area internationally, looking at stress and mental health and health, physical health outcomes, is it says it's comprised of anxiety, insecurity, low self-esteem, social isolation, and lack of control over work and home life. And I think thinking about those things and saying, let's look at the lives of women we serve, let's look at the lives of families we serve, and see where their experience fits into those categories, and then think, what can we do to address those things with that sort of finer eye than just this big amorphous concept of stress? And really understanding, and the World Health Organization definitely understands this, how all of those experiences or aspects of experience are tied to social marginalization. And really, that it's partly related to poverty. It's partly related, I mean, if you don't have enough to eat, you don't have enough to eat, and that's obviously going to affect your health. But there's something that seems to be going on that has to do with social experience in terms of marginalization psychologically, socially, and not just not having enough stuff. And, you know, I don't want to take lightly not having enough stuff, and I want to recognize that some of that psychosocial experience, you know, anxiety and security, those have to do with not having enough stuff. But it's also got to do with sort of how much are you not the person your society was set up for? how much are you the person without a car in a city that requires you to have a car to have a job? How much are you the person who can't afford childcare where childcare is expensive? Those are parts of your social experience that certainly are related to material well-being, but also imply that you're sort of out of fit. And I think that's one of the relevant questions for families of kids raising children with special health care needs. W.E.B. Du Bois, a very smart man, said it, I think, quite touchingly and magnificently, to be a poor man is hard, but to be a poor race in a land of dollars is the very bottom of hardships, from his beautiful book, The Souls of Black Food. Black folk. I'm obviously thinking it's lunchtime. Sorry to have messed up that gorgeous quote with my malapropism. So what does that say about what we should be doing? We're trying to think about what we can do around each of those items that are in our definition of life course theory. In terms of addressing social determinants, I've handed out there's not nearly enough to go around, so I hope people will share it, but a handout about a program we have that I'll say a little more about called Healthy Start in Housing that actually is targeting housing, city-subsidized housing, to high-risk pregnant women as a way of improving their social circumstances. We are heavily investing, moving all of our Healthy Start sites to a centering model, requiring that they make that shift and saying, you're welcome to go on delivering prenatal care however you want, but if you want our Healthy Start funding, you've got to move to centering, because we believe that it affects women's ability to, sort of all of these aspects of life course theory. In terms of stress, again, centering, and some other programs we have a fatherhood initiative like many other cities. We have what we've called women's circles in our programs. In terms of early risk, focusing on teen health, we have a lot to learn about preconceptional health and how to do it better. We're very interested in what other people are doing in that area. We also have a clinical task force that's addressing that, and I'll mention their work in a minute. A lot of emphasis on breastfeeding promotion in terms of, in this case, not necessarily preconceptional, but interconceptional health, but also, of course, the health of the baby. The babies start in life with breastfeeding. A number of initiatives in that area. And again, both the clinical task force, and as you'll see, and centering are ways of addressing the cumulative risk that women accumulate over the life course. And then in line with Amy's point about equity, we are also part of a national learning collaborative that's trying to figure out, and I think in some ways this is the softest thing we're doing, but ultimately it may be one of the most important, trying to figure out how to have conversations about racism with the communities that are most effective and then within the broader city as a whole, how to talk about this in ways that are persuasive and empowering to people. Healthy Start in Housing, as I said, provides 75 units of housing that we can offer to pregnant women who are at high risk. They have to be pregnant. They have to have some kind of physiological risk in terms of the pregnancy outcome, and they have to have high risk of homelessness. Again, handout about that, and I'd be glad to provide it to other people who didn't get one that gives a lot of the details. I'm, in order to spare time, not going to go into it in more detail now, but the essence of it is both addressing the enormous stress associated with the idea that you're about to have a baby and there's no nest. I mean, you think about how fundamental that is in pregnancy and how stressful that is, and we're thrilled to be able to address that directly, albeit only for 75 women. Centering is, for those who are not familiar, a group model of care that builds the idea of woman-to-woman support into or alongside of the delivery of typical prenatal care through a group process. And it's really that group process that we think is at the heart of its effectiveness. It is an evidence-based practice. We're really hoping to shift it to become the default model of care in the city, both through our Healthy Start program and, knock on wood, we've applied for one of the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Strong Start grants to try to spread it even further throughout the city. Our clinical task force really has an overt agenda and a covert agenda. The overt agenda is the bringing together of clinical leaders throughout the city in OBGYN with the Public Health Commission to talk about what can clinicians do to help address these life course issues. And their focus has been a mix. They're looking for a kind of mixed agenda that includes a clinical intervention around standardizing the use of progesterone to avert preterm birth, but also thinking about what can doctors do to, for example, assure that women have better access to social benefits and public supports and so on. The overt agenda is to address the clinical issues that doctors had on their minds when they got together with us. The covert agenda is really to get doctors talking to us about these life course issues in a more fundamental way. And so these are the sort of the four things that the task force is doing: this progesterone protocol, using a directory of resources for Boston called the Online Advocate citywide to give women access to benefits and so on, adoption of an intervention for follow-up on adverse birth outcomes as a sentinel event, so really intervening very intensively with women who have a preterm birth or a low birth weight birth or a loss, and trying to really develop a sort of a science of understanding in this kind of fine detail that I was talking about, what's going on in those women's lives. And then at a policy level, working with these clinicians to improve access at community health centers to long-acting contraception. And I won't go into the details of that. So thinking about this agenda as a whole and what it means for an agency like ours to put equity front and center, well, you know, first of all, there are lots of questions and not a lot of answers. How do we engage women and their communities in this discussion? I mean, the very stresses that make women's lives hard make it a challenge to sort of say, let's have a theoretical discussion. So how do we make the discussion meaningful in an immediate sense, in a direct way, in people's lives? How do we make it salient? And I think very importantly that some of the conversation nationally around life course that has particularly focused on early childhood has tended to have a victim-blaming tone towards mothers, and that it's really crucial to recognize that this is something that affects the whole family, that there aren't good guys and bad guys in the family, victims and non-victims, that we're talking about stress in the environment. And of course, people respond in some ways that are healthy and in some ways that are not. But that we're not, this is not about saving babies from inadequate mothers. It's about improving outcomes for families as a whole and for our nation as a whole. So our strategies are to engage with a lot of partners. Healthy Start and Housing is completely dependent on an entirely new relationship to the Housing Authority. The Clinical Task Force involves a much more systematic relationship to providers than we've ever had before, particularly to clinical leaders. So new partnerships, a conversation with the community as a whole, and then, you know, a real effort that I think others are engaged in as well, to just be sponges for whatever's going on in other places that we can learn and grow from, so that we aren't, you know, not sort of struggling in Boston alone. Thank you very much. This is a great timer. So I'm depending on the timing, I'm glad to take questions now, and I'm really sorry I have to leave before the end because it kind of distorts the conversation a little bit. But if there are specific questions.
So, you know, centering pregnancy and the group model, obviously a lot of evidence behind that. And yet, the other move is towards evidence-based early childhood home visiting, which is obviously not a group model. Any thoughts about?
Well, we're actually trying to tie, I mean, first of all, there is a centering parenting. We're very interested in that and have other interventions that do try to bring parents, I mean, the fundamental answer is we didn't design the home visiting program. And I think there's a lot of reason to think about, although also a lot of challenges in thinking about group parenting efforts and what they might look like. One specific answer to that is that we are going to be piloting a newborn home visiting, a one-time home visiting effort in Boston as part of our state's non-evidence-based, you can be more experimental money. And our plan is to use the centering sites and the prenatal process around centering as the way to get consent and to introduce that to women so that instead of getting this sort of phone call from somebody you've never met, you're going to be in the prenatal visit, and someone will come in and say, hi, you know, I work for the Healthy Baby Child Health. A healthy child program. I'm a nurse, and we do home visits to everybody in this community. You know, you'll get to see me again after you have the baby if you're interested. You have to, you know, you have to agree to that, but we'll come and take a look and make sure you're doing okay, baby's doing okay, is there anything you need? So we try to really link it to centering. Other questions, comments? I'll raise my question for Amy now, and you can, which is just a comment that from my years of experience as the CSHCN director for Massachusetts, I mean, one of the points I think about really recognizing the social import of Life Course is my experience is that one of the absolutely critical times developmentally for kids with special needs is the transition from elementary school to middle school, when families can no longer organize their kids' social lives. And I don't know how many of you have experience with families of kids with special needs, but there's this sort of horrible moment where if your kid, where difference becomes so important to other kids and they become very conventional, and it was okay to be friends with the kid who had, you know, a chronic condition or a mobility impairment or, God help us, a developmental delay when they were 4 or 8, but when they're 12, not so easy. And sort of thinking about what are the inflection points for this population may be, you know, may be different, and if you are thinking about that.